Right now, I'm very happy to welcome to our program Luis Perez, professor of history at the University of North Carolina. He's editor of Cuban Journal, and he's the author of more than 10 books on Cuba, and some of his titles include The Structure of Cuban History, Meaning and Purpose of the Past, and Cuba Between Reform and Revolution. Professor Perez, it's great to have you in the program tonight. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Good evening.
So we've all certainly taken in the news of Fidel Castro's death a week or so ago. His remains were buried just yesterday, 9 days of official mourning in Cuba. We've seen the video footage of the celebrations in Miami's Little Havana neighborhood. There's a lot of history there that I'm sure we're not going to get to cover in all its details this evening, Professor Perez. But I thought we'd spend a bit of time on Fidel Castro's legacy. And certainly maybe in the latter half of our discussion, we'll talk about the future of U.S.-Cuban relations now that it seems that the opening and the efforts at normalization that were jointly made progress on by President Obama and Cuba's President Raul Castro may very well be in jeopardy, certainly according to the rhetoric we've heard from President-elect Trump. But to start out with Fidel Castro and his legacy, certainly I think I can safely say that much of the retrospective of Fidel Castro's life in our U.S. corporate media, it was particularly one-sided. You know, I think it's almost universal that our media portrayed him as an evil guy, a guy who, you know, had been excoriated through the years of the Cold War and since, and deservedly so. Not much said in his favor in terms of the progress made in Cuba itself. So maybe you can give us a fuller picture than we've been getting on CNN and a lot of the other news coverage in the papers and alike.
Well, I think it's appalling and distressing to have passed the last 10 days and listening to the reports from all the main mainstream media, anywhere from CNN to NPR to the newspapers, and that 55 years later we have not moved beyond this image of Fidel Castro as the devil incarnate, as someone who seems to have really struck a nerve in the American psyche, a person who seems to have just aroused endless antipathy and ire and indignation. And so there is this unrelieved attack on Castro, the person, the politician, the political leader. And part of the problem is that we have gotten caught up in historians debate this, and undergraduate history majors debate this, and this whole question of the great man thesis. You know, does history make the man, or does the man make the history? And we have seemed to have really just so locked in Fidel Castro. We have so ripped him out of his context, both past and present, that he operates, that we confer upon him this status of someone who's floating, you know, above time and space, and everything bad that's happened is his fault. And it's an easy way where the society, the culture, the political system can direct all its ire and its venom on one person. You know, if it wasn't for him, things wouldn't have happened the way they happened. So he becomes an easy target. And I think the problem with that, the profound problem with that, is that in many ways, Fidel Castro is a product of his history. Fidel Castro is definitely an actor, but he was acted upon. He comes out of a history. He comes out of a culture. He comes out of a society. And the idea that one would take him out of that context really is to distort and disfigure the character of Cuban history. Fidel Castro is eminently a man of his history, of his culture, of his time. And so when he's pulled out of that context, he becomes a one-dimensional person. He's just he's evil, he's an evildoer, he's malevolent, he's mischievous, and that's what we're stuck with. That almost everything that we have heard and read for the last 10 days have fallen to this category. That here is this guy who's just, you know, who has no organic roots to anybody, to anything, to any past, to any society, any culture. He just floats out there, and he becomes a very easy target.
Professor Perez, we don't have a lot of time left, but maybe you could give us your own brief assessment of Fidel Castro's accomplishments and his flaws, in your view.
Well, his principal accomplishment is to articulate the desire of a people to enact a legacy of a nation that goes to whose antecedents go back to the 19th century, of people who have been struggling for self-determination and national sovereignty since the 1850s and have been thwarted and frustrated at almost every turn. And so what I think his legacy is, has been able to summon the Cuban people into fulfilling what was commonly perceived to be a mission, a purpose, a legacy to redeem. And so I think we understand his legacy as one of having to he had led by expressing in many profound ways a history as a way, as a politics, history as a means of political mobilization, history as a means of agency and self-determination.
And what about Cuba itself? Upon Fidel Castro's death, there are a lot of U.S. Media reports about the impoverished condition of the Cuban people, about their lack of progress over these many years since Castro came to power and his brother succeeded him. I wonder if you would just recap for our audience what accomplishments have been made that are quite starkly overlooked by our U.S. media coverage of the reality of Cuba and for Cubans.
That's a legitimate point, and I think that, you know, that you raise that, I think, is a significant. That's been essential to the discussions of the last 10 days. And you know, a couple of things on this. One is, when people talk about how bad the economy, how difficult times are, the adversity that is befalling the Cuban people, I think it's always important for your listeners and informed people to say, what's the frame of reference? What's the Cuba compared to who? What are we comparing Cuba? When we say that, excuse me, when we say the Cuban economy is in shambles, well, what does that, in reference to what? Secondly, one must appreciate that this economy has been under siege for 55 years. This economy is in difficult times. In part because in the 1960s, the United States waged a whole series of covert operations that was designed to destroy and undermine the Cuban infrastructure. Acts that today rise to the level of what we would call today state-sponsored terrorism. The embargo has as its ultimate objective, has had as its ultimate objective, 55 years of a punitive policy designed to inflict misery and adversity on the Cuban people in the hope that by inflicting misery and adversity on the Cuban people would rise up and overthrow the Cuban government. That was the purpose of the embargo. And this is not to attribute to the embargo the Cuban difficulties, but surely one must factor in the embargo as contributing to Cuban conditions.
And how about state repression? You often hear U.S. politicians, both Democrats and Republicans, talk about Cuba as the gulag in the Caribbean. Rolls off the tongue, right? What is the reality there? We often hear interviews with dissidents in Cuba, although they are frequently arrested. There are people in prison in Cuba for expressing a different point of view. But what can you tell us about any nuance, if there is, if it's important to mention here, about what are the boundaries of free speech in Cuba?
The boundaries of free speech in Cuba are limited. It is a system that has that acts on authoritarian impulses. It is a system that is not reluctant to use repressive means to maintain an internal consensus. It is a system that has spawned a fairly elaborate surveillance and intelligence systems. That said, I think it's important for informed listeners to appreciate that Cuba offers a cautionary tale. Cuba has developed over the last 50 years into a national security state. It has lived for the last 50, 55 years next to the most powerful country in the world that has as its ultimate objective, and states so bluntly, the overthrow of the Cuban government, that is regime change. So national security has been an obsession in Cuba. And as we know, in this society, in this culture, since 9/11, when one invokes the idea, the proposition of national security, civil liberties, constitutional processes, due processes, little by little, get eroded and eventually disappear. So when we look at Cuba, it's important to realize that this is a country that has been under siege by another country, and it has taken all the measures that the state feels appropriate to maintain the integrity of the nation, and that includes repression as a means of maintaining the national sovereignty of the Cuban Republic. So I say that Cuba offers us a cautionary tale. When we defer and yield to national security concerns, eventually those national security concerns will, bit by bit, erode civil liberties and constitutional processes. And Cuba offers an example of what happens under those circumstances.
Thank you. We're speaking tonight here on Counterpoint with Luis Perez, professor of history at the University of North Carolina and editor of Cuban Journal and author of many books on Cuba and its in the context of Latin American and Caribbean history. Professor Perez, there are some interesting perspectives on Cuba you don't ordinarily hear in the United States. And one is you've got people from around Latin America and the Caribbean who want to immigrate to Cuba because of the great education and health care that's offered on that island nation, something which is certainly not a focus of U.S. coverage of Cuba, either before or after the death of Fidel Castro. And I've had some interesting experiences traveling in the Caribbean, where I've actually found people who I got to know quite well who look forward to traveling to Cuba to get free health care for serious conditions that couldn't be treated on their islands where they were in the Caribbean. So there's a whole different kind of view of Cuba from the point of view of people living in developing countries, right?
Yeah, I mean, there is. I mean, there is. Cuba offers what they call medical tourism for much of the world, including the United States, and certainly Latin America and the Caribbean. They have a world-class health system that is suffering the consequences of hard times, but nevertheless maintains and more than adequate coverage for its people. And there are people who travel to Cuba to undertake procedures, medical procedures that are either unavailable or beyond the reach of ordinary citizens.
Well, I wanted to get to the future of the opening that we saw Raul Castro and President Barack Obama open up over the last year or so. Professor Perez, now that President Obama and Raul Castro work to open diplomatic relations between our two countries and begin the process of trying to normalize economic relations, we have the election of President Trump, whose rhetoric since November 8th has really cast a dark shadow on the project of normalization, threatening to torpedo the opening that has already been underway now. What is your view of the future of U.S.-Cuba relations?
I think right at this moment, it's all very murky, very very obscure. We have, when candidate Trump was campaigning in Miami, I think it was in October, gave one or two interviews, and he took a hard line on Cuba, what one would expect him to do campaigning in Miami. So one doesn't necessarily attribute too much significance to that, because Democrats and Republicans have been doing this for the last 55 years. However, the comments and the statements that came in the aftermath of Fidel Castro's death are worrisome, because it's where President Obama's message to Cuba and the Cuban people was framed in something of a Rorschach blot, that you could read that any way you want, but it was a perfectly diplomatic statement that could mean all things to all people, totally inoffensive. The comments that came out of President-elect Trump was rude, severe, hard, and hardly what you would call diplomatic. And so I think anybody who the folks who work at the Ministry of Foreign Relations in Havana, in Cuba, hearing that, have got to assume the worst. It is, one despairs to think that after two years going on, actually almost exactly 2 years of incremental change, incremental opening up, step by step, moving towards some normal relations, that within another month we may go back to the worst days. I don't even know where it would be, the Reagan years perhaps, or worse.
Now, what about the Cuban people? I think it's pretty well reported that the Cubans are very much in favor, generally, of the opening to the United States, having access to more communications with the United States, more tourism, of course, is going to be profitable for a lot of Cubans who may have jobs in the tourist industry there that will certainly increase and become more profitable. But you also have businesses in the United States that are looking forward to making a buck in Cuba as well. Might they put pressure on an incoming Trump administration to not scuttle the normalization, because they stand to lose if things go back into a Cold War mode?
Well, this is going to be interesting. I mean, we have models, we have paradigms of capitalism and the relationship between property and men and women of means and of privilege, who we've always believed that have access to the levers of power. And so there are key sectors of the American corporate structure that look at Cuba covetously. The airlines, they've just inaugurated flights this past week to Havana. The hotel industry, the processed food industry, just a whole host of sectors. Agriculture, who look at the opening to Cuba as a promising new field for investment and profits. Now, what we don't know is, does American Airlines, does Delta, does United, does JetBlue, does Southwest, do they have access to and or influence over the new administration? And all these kind of units, these floating pieces, these gears of the system, can they exercise sufficient influence to arrest and reverse these kind of tendencies to kind of take a super hard line against Cuba? I don't know. In other words, it would be interesting to see, to test the paradigms of capitalism as they have affect policy of this new administration.
Well, Professor Perez, in closing here, I'd like to ask you what your view is in terms of what's in the interest of the American people. There are probably some people listening to this program tonight and thinking about this topic. Certainly, it's probably not high on their agenda, but many Americans won't see any benefit or drawback as to whether Cuba, U.S. has Cuba, normalized relations with Cuba or not. But from your perspective, why should Americans care about where this newly opened relationship may be headed under a new Trump administration?
I'm not sure I have an answer to that. I am, you know, it's sort of like them, 150 countries in the world, 200 countries in the world, and I mean, what makes Cuba unique is that we as a people, this as a nation, has a particular obsession with Cuba, and hence, you know, the death of Fidel Castro resonates. Will the lives of ordinary Americans be improved or affected one way or the other if we have normal relations with Cuba? I'm going to say probably not, you know. I mean, I just, as do as any other country in the world, except for the superpowers. But I think in that sense, one would wish that there is a desire to live amicably and felicitously with neighboring countries, that these are, there's a significant Cuban-American population that lives in the United States. And there's a long tradition of Cuban and U.S. relations between Cubans and Americans. You know, it's anybody who saw the Cubs play this past year, it's, you know, Chapman is a Cuban pitcher with a 100-mile-plus-an-hour fastball, and Cuban music and Cuban food and Cuban literature and Cuban film. And so, you know, what does this amount to? I just think it's, I think the Cuban presence in American society, both inside the U.S. and from the island itself, is, has served to enrich American culture and has provided kinds of diversities and possibilities that would otherwise not have been available.
All right, well, Professor Perez, I appreciate you spending time here looking at this the topic of U.S.-Cuba relations and its future under a new administration, and to look at the past as well with the legacy of Fidel Castro. Professor Perez, what would you recommend a website for more information and articles, some discussion of your books? If you'd like to leave some information, I'm sure it'll be most appreciated.
You know, I think probably two websites that I would recommend people to go to is look at the U.S., the Ministry of Foreign Relations. Just look up Ministry of Foreign Relations Cuba and the U.S. Embassy Cuba. And I think having access to those web pages gives you very interesting points, counterpoints as to how this policy and U.S. policy and Cuban reactions are going to develop.
Okay. Thanks so much. You have a website that you want to mention for your own writings?
No, I don't have one.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks so much, Professor Perez. Appreciate it again. And we'll look forward to staying in touch on this topic. It would be important.
And you have a good evening.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Luis Perez, professor of history at the University of North Carolina and editor of Cuban Journal.